hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords, Field Major Styre of the Sontaran Empire, and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels, alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, though you're only linked to the past, maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics, brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
Chowing down on raw rat meat now the rations have run out this week is artist Libby Reed, known in Doctor Who fandom as T-Dalek. We at Cutaway Comics are blessed to have her working on our forthcoming Iris Wildtime one-shot comic, which forms part of the Gods and Monsters saga. Libby, hello!
Hello!
Thanks for having me.
It's lovely to be here.
That was one of the shortest intros I've done, because you are very young. Would that be fair to say? Do you mind being called very young? Very young and very talented?
It's very kind, thanks. Yeah, I'm 28 now. It's the funny thing, when you reach that age, you're like, oh no, I'm going to be 30. And then, you know, everyone older than 30 is like, I wish I was still 30.
28.
And it's not that big of a deal, yeah.
I remember being a kid and crying because I realised I would be 28 when the millennium came and I wouldn't be able to go to a party. Because that's how old 28 seemed to me when I was about 10. And in reality, I had food poisoning in Port Sudan and was covered in bed bugs on the millennium.
Ooh, no.
So I didn't do anything fun anyway, other than lose a stone through illness.
Yeah. But we had a big fancy dress party with my family. I think my cousins were the tweenies. It was very weird.
Oh my God, you were 5. Oh my God, you were 5. Or 4 even, on the millennium.
I was 5, yes. And I remember I got really tired. I fell asleep. And then all the fireworks went off. And I was like, why are they having fireworks? I'm trying to have a nap. I was just so tired and annoyed by then. It's quite funny looking back. I didn't paint the town or anything. I had a nap. Dressed as a cat. I was having a good time.
Well, weirdly, I was busy napping because I'd been vomiting and other things for 48 hours straight in Africa. So, very, very strange. After I was building up, the year 2000 was such a big thing because of science fiction and 2000 AD. And I was so, as a kid, couldn't wait to be in the 21st century. And then how I saw it in was watching repeats on CNN. In my hotel room, of how the world was probably going to end because of Y2K. Mm. Oh, no, it hasn't, after all. That was just literally hallucinating.
We made it through.
We made
Prince
it through.
Prince wrote a song about it, and it wasn't even all that. It was.
Yeah. But anyway, I won't mention how young you are again, because it's more the how talented you are that we're more interested in. So I've met you once in real life, which in these days is actually... It's quite good going, because the amount of people I haven't met in real life that I see on these screens all the time. But yeah, so I met you with Gareth Thought Bubble, and I was trying to work out, was it 2022 Thought Bubble or was it 2021 Thought Bubble? Because time is going very...
It was 2021.
It was. I thought it might be because... So this is the second one we haven't been to. But yes, that's right, because we were there at John Ridgeway. So that was 2021. Mm. Comics move slowly, doesn't it? But...
It does,
But thanks to Theo, he introduced us, and you gave us your amazing portfolio, and Gareth hired you almost immediately to work on Iris Wildtime, which is just amazing. We'll talk about that later. So I guess this is a Doctor Who podcast, but you are a comic book artist. Is that how you describe yourself, or an illustrator, or a bit of both?
I have to do a bit of both. I definitely towards comics. It's kind of a funny place because you get a little bit of that imposter syndrome. You're a little bit like, oh, is it comics? Yeah, I guess I am. I guess I do. So yeah, I describe myself as a comic artist. I took an illustration degree when I was in that would have been 2016 to 2019 when I graduated. From that, I worked for a little bit for an illustration design company called Clockwork Soldier. They do like little cutout paper kits, and you see them in like just about every garden center. Every, lots of gift shops, lots of National Trust places, that kind of thing. That was really fun. I was a paid intern. That was really good. Then winter of 2020, yeah, 2019, I got a job with this team who was making a comic about the environment as a sort of hero, save the environment, which was called The Renegade. They were with Dawning Kindersley. And sort of that was very opportunistic. Sort of heard about it through the grapevine, hopped onto that, and it was a really, really lovely team. Most of them were kind of my age. Made a friend there who's, also really into Doctor Who. He knows, well, he's on the same pub quiz team, or he was for a while, as Robert Shearman. So that was a bit of a weird
Oh, wow.
coincidence there.
Yeah,
But I was
yeah.
like, wow, that sounds brilliant. He knows Katie Manning. He's written plays and stuff, and he was writing for this comic. I was so lucky to get on that gig when I did, because of course next year rolls around, it's 2020, we're all indoors, and of course we could set up Zoom. I was lucky to be in work. Not only that, but it was work. It was very, very hard work, but it was something I really enjoyed. It was something I'd always wanted to do. It was something I couldn't have dreamt I would have been doing. So we had a run of three for that. And it was interesting because by the time it got round to 2021, we'd just wrapped up the third and final issue. And because we were in because it was an environmental comic, we had just come when I went and I saw you at Thought Bubble, I'd actually just come down from Edinburgh because we'd gone up to the COP26 to go and do a talk there, which was in Glasgow, obviously. But because I was up at that end of the country, some south coast trash. But it was it just made sense to just stay in Scotland for a bit and then make my way down from there. I've got family sort of in and around Yorkshire, so Harrogate wasn't that far by then. But so and then I spoke to you guys, and I spoke to Theo, and he has always just been such a lovely person, so encouraging. Again, it's that funny thing of you don't really meet people in real life. It was someone I met on Twitter, but have the same enthusiasm, especially for Doctor Who, but just liking I had done a bit of work for him on a private commission because he wanted some art of his characters done. And he happened to bump into him at the con. We chatted and he recommended me to you
Oh,
guys.
wow.
So I came very shyly and I said,
I
I came to say hi.
know. It was brilliant. It was worth going to Thought Bubble because as I was sort of saying to you in the emails before, I love Thought Bubble. It's been years since I've been to it. I just love it as a punter because I love comics.
Oh yeah, completely.
But as for Cutaway, that first year was we found out it was very hard because you're there in a massive marketplace, and to go. So every conversation had to be, do you like Doctor Who? And then it'd be like, no, don't really like it. And he's like, okay, well, really, but you still have to talk to people. So we were hoarse, didn't celebrate. So one thing we learned was Thought Bubble, much as we love it, is probably not our place to go and sell comics because when we go to a Doctor Who convention, at least that first question is not necessary. It's
Yeah, you've
obviously you like
already got
Doctor Who
that.
because you're here. It's do you like comics? Who's your favorite Doctor? Which of these eras that we tap into do you think you might go for? So, and generally, so people, they fly off the shelves at Doctor Who cons. But yes, but I always
Of
say,
course, yeah.
I'm glad we went because we wouldn't have met you, and we wouldn't. You've just delivered the sort of final art on Iris Wildthyme, haven't you? Which
I have,
is
yes.
absolutely gorgeous. I can't wait to see that
Thank you.
with the speech bubbles on and fully designed up. It'll be out. It'll be out quite soon. But no, because I'm recording these in advance, it might be out. If it is,
Yes,
I will
no, it's
make sure I
true.
say when I release it.
Yeah.
But we'll
I have my
see.
friends asking, oh, when's the Kickstarter? Have we missed it? I was like, no, we haven't missed it. It's coming.
Yeah.
I've just put in the final pages, so
Comics
got
is like
super
working for a really
excited.
fun glacier. It's like, here it
Yeah.
comes. Here comes the fun. Yeah, it's miles away, but it's coming down the
Yeah.
mountain,
Well, for
inch by
me though,
inch.
it yeah, for me For me, it's a bit of a relief because you want to be able to spend that time to make it good if you can. Sometimes that could be a trap because you can be too much of a perfectionist. And it's never going to feel perfect enough. It's never going to feel ready. You have to get to a point where you're like, actually, you know what? This is fine. This is good. If you keep going with this, you will never write or make another thing ever again.
Yeah,
because you've spent too long. So it's a good exercise in learning to let go. But so it's sort of blessing and a curse when it's slow. And it's comforting hearing other comic writers and creators. This was one of the panels I was at actually this time around, so this weekend. It's such a relief to hear that other comic writers or writers and art people who write and do the art. You know, it's the same thing, we have a similar process, and it's like, oh thank God. I feel validated. I feel like I'm doing it right. This is a good place to be. I know what I'm doing a little bit. So
I think more than a little bit. It's brilliant stuff. But we'll talk about Iris Wildtime in particular later on. So this pod always takes everyone back to their childhood, inevitably, because we are here to talk about a children's show, which most people don't get into in adulthood. They get into in their childhood, usually before they can form memories. So. But before we get on to who, so comics, how long have they been part of your life? Are they a very early thing as well?
Well, it's interesting because for the longest time, I felt like a bit of a fraud because a lot of people, when they talk about comics, they talk about the big two. So how into DC, how into Marvel, there's that kind of, you know, world and expectation, but you know a lot about this lore because there's kind of, you know, because of fandom and things like that, especially with the interconnectivity we have now and, you know, the access to as much knowledge as you could possibly want on a subject. I felt like I haven't read Marvel that much. Marvel, I haven't really. It's a different story for DC, which I'll get into. I've read some of the best ones, definitely. Ones that you can't really miss. And it felt like a big fraud. And then suddenly it popped into my brain. It's like, what are you talking about? You've read tons of comics. They were just all European comics. I read, when I was little, it wasn't so much me, but my brother used to get the Beano every week. You know, every single week. And all these copies stacking up. And of course, once he's done with them, I'm reading them over his shoulder. We're sitting, like, reading them together. And I loved it. And, you know, they were always... It was very fun. It was always grotesque. It was just this really daft sense of humor I loved. But the other thing that we read a lot of was Tintin. And I always liked those. I always liked, they were, you know, reading them back, they're quite suspenseful. They're very good, you know, children's stories, adventure stories.
Amazing, amazing stuff.
And I do love them, yeah. But in my brain, it's like, you know, it completely skipped over because that those counters comics. I think the thing I saw that made me go, okay, I want to make comics. This is what I want to do with my life. Was in 2011. My godmum bought a little comic. She lived over in London. She still does. She actually works at the BBC, so she has some fun stories. But she bought this little comic by a printing company called Nobrow. It's called Hilda Falk, and it's all about this little girl. It was like a short one-off. She lives in, if this is familiar to anyone by now, ever since it's become a huge Netflix cartoon a couple of years back. It's all about this little girl who lives in sort of the mountains of Norway, and she goes on adventures with all these sort of magical creatures. And it was so gentle, and it was so fun, and it was so cute. It was a kind of comic I hadn't really seen before. I mean, it's this kind of market.
I've never heard of it, but is it kind of Moomin-y like? I know Moomins are Finland and not Scandinavian. I know from my Finnish friends being in Finland.
Is that
I know Finland isn't Scandinavian.
Well, I say Scandinavia, but it's like I
was get very cross Scandinavia. Say, Scandinavian.
Oh, what do you mean? It's useful. I found all of them all in one go, but cool. Couple of later issues of just, you know, for your audience. Oh, wow. I've just moved.
Oh wow!
So
Hilda and the Midnight Giant—they are lovely. They do have a vibe of Tintin about them, even though they look completely different. But just something about the typography and the general, I definitely. So that's a Netflix show, is it? As well.
It is. Yeah, I think the final series is coming out.
I'll have to. Is it suitable for children?
very suitable for children.
I might watch that with my lad.
That's kind of the audience. It's like absolutely lovely.
That looks lovely. That's why I'm a street.
You're showing him a lot of Doctor Who stuff, or is he a bit?
Well, he's you can't force anything on them, but he far is 8 and has still stayed liking Doctor Who. Whereas my other two boys,
that's good,
kind of went their own way with Marvel and the MCU and The Walking Dead and just Minecraft invading their brain.
We're too cool for Doctor Who, Dad.
They still watch it, but it's a bit like people whose dads follow a football team. They watch the football for their dad. So sometimes they go, "Oh, I see Doctor Who's coming back, Dad." Thinking about what age you were when things were happening, 2005, when the show, as I say, came back, as you, I imagine you were like, there's this new TV show. I mean, when did you first watch Doctor Who? Or if you
know. It was 2005. It was funny because I remember distinctly and very, like, a weird coincidence. I would often ask, you know, well, being a kid, I'd ask my mum lots of questions. I'd just be like, someone's asked her, "Mum, it was often about my own anxieties and stuff, and like trying to show me that. What was a TV show that you were scared of when you were a kid? Because inevitably there are things you're scared of." And she sort of wrinkled her nose. "Well, there was this show called Doctor Who, and it was all about this guy, but he's an alien. He has this spaceship and it looks like a little box, but you go inside, it's all bigger on the inside." And she described that to me, and I was like, "Oh, I see." And then, you know, it came on. We watched Rose. We were all sitting together as a family. And this time, Mum was like, "Oh, it's making the noise. Oh, here we go." And she, like, gave me a cushion. It's like, "You have to hide behind the sofa now." I was like, "Why?" She was like, it's what you do. Yeah, it was Rose. The Autons came on. It first, as soon as that thing's head moved, I just wet myself. I was not feeling that. I was a very nervy child, but I just got completely freaked out by that, you know. I still enjoyed it, but I was scared of anything plastic in the house. It was going to come and get me. I couldn't for a long time, like deep into my teenage years, I would get a little bit nervous around shop dummies. Deeply sinister. They're obviously out to get us. And then after that, so I didn't watch it. I refused to watch it. I refused to do that to myself. But my brother, he lapped it up. He definitely did that thing older brothers did, where as soon as he finished an episode, he run upstairs where I was holed away in my room, and he would tell me, you know, point by point, what happened in every episode. But he's a very good storyteller. So often, you know, even though it took me a while to go back and watch, you know, that series with Christopher Eccleston, the first New Who series, it was really... You know, I did get a good idea of what was going on. He only told me about the empty child, and I couldn't sleep for a week. I was so scared. It was quite a force of nature that, but you know, everyone was talking about it. Our mum was away for a week. We were calling her on the phone before we went to sleep. We were like, "Oh my God, sleep is horrible. It's gonna get me." And it was quite funny. It wasn't until, you know, the next series. You know, I watched it via the repeats more than anything. I remember being scared because I loved David Tennant, and because we'd seen Christopher Eccleston, who's also amazing, but it's because we'd seen him regenerate, I got it into my head that he regenerates at the end of every series. So I was like, "Oh no, we're going to lose him," and I was really sad. And my mum was like, "Oh, don't worry, because they don't always regenerate. David Tom Tennant. Baker was there for ages," kind of thing. I got into that. I started watching it properly at around the third series, which was kind of when I got really into it. Sort of since then, I've been hooked, more or less. I've been very faithful to watching it. I've still been a bit spotty in some places. Often, something that's quite important about my experience is the fact that I'm an autistic person, which is probably... You know, it's probably quite a few people in the fandom. But often if I'm really excited about something, I can get a bit overstimulated. It's kind of like I need to lie down, which just sounds really odd. But and you know, it was kind of like, if you know, I didn't want to get in a funk about something, so I'm, you know, things that I play, and now I can just watch it again if you missed it. But I kind of grew with the show from there. I grew with my you know, wanting to draw things, Daleks especially, and draw lots of things related to Doctor Who. A lot of times my interests outside of it, like I love my animals. I was known as the dragon girl at school when I was like 10, 11. And because I was drawing dragons all the time, you know, I love my animals and stuff. Daleks are really hard to draw when you've only just started to do it. So, you know, that was something I became known, at least online now, for being fairly good at drawing and being kind of known for, especially for what, I mean, I've got the name, T Dalek.
Yeah.
But yeah, I kind of drew and learned around that. And it was, you know, I think as well, Doctor Who being so creative, it's really fun to engage with as an artist because there's so much to see. You know, I love the side of it that's monsters, but I also love, well, yeah, doing characters. And I love expressions. I love how, something I could probably go into, I do love how liquid the show is in terms of like its lore and its tone, among other things, just being so old and already being on a premise that is very hard to pin down. A lot can change. It's about time travel. It's, I think, something that a lot of people miss. And I don't think this is a bad thing necessarily, because it shows people's passion, people's dedication. It's just how changeable it can be, you know, compared to a lot of shows where I think, you know, things have to make sense for certain rules you can abide to. I think also it being a kids, quote unquote, kids show. When you say it like that, that sounds really kind of, people say think it's a kids show. It's actually highly intellectual. But yes. No, yes. because it's
it was made by the BBC's drama department, not the children's department.
Oh, yeah. Well, people
are always shouting on the internet.
Here's that idea. Well, in fact, we had Sarah Jane Adventures as well when I was younger. It was kind of, that's for the younger audience, and it still scared loads of people. But it was more like family, you know, it being designed for everyone, for mum, for dad, for kids, that kind of thing. You know, it does sit in this quite interesting space where a lot of shows don't. I've been saying all of this, sometimes it sounds like I'm rambling and I've forgotten the point, but I think there's just so much fun to be had with it. There's so many ideas and places that have been played with and that can be gone to, and there are so many more as well. It was really interesting because when I was speaking to an older fan when Jodie Whittaker's first series was coming out, and you know, I was quite excited about some of the stories they were going to tell. And I was talking about, you know, it was going to be a Rosa Parks one. And my friend said, you know, they sort of confessed, I don't really know that much about Rosa Parks, which was surprising to me. We'd done civil rights era in school and things like that. And it was interesting that there was this kind of gap in knowledge. You know, I had a confession that I didn't know anything about the partition of India. Until Demons of Punjab.
Yeah.
And, you know, I felt quite ashamed of that. It isn't your fault for what you weren't told about. But at the same time, you know, I think because of all of this, because of all the stories that have and haven't been told, it does lend itself very well to longevity.
Mm.
So I think we're very lucky to have it. And it's quite an interesting case study as well in terms of media writing.
Yeah, it's just totally unique show in many ways, and hence we're about, well, to be 60 years old. And we're about to see. So your first choice is Dalek, the actual episode Dalek. You mentioned Rob Shearman being on a quiz team with you earlier. So, or was it your friend who?
It was the friend's quiz team. Let's want to get fat. When you say, "Oh, I know them," we're like best mates. Who are you?
It was all right.
Pub quiz team is going to be how much you're going to remember anyone anyway. But
but that's cool. But because I've interviewed Rob for this as well, so I know him in passing, but not very well at all.
He seems like a very lovely man. Yeah.
Oh, he is lovely. And Dalek is picked by a lot of people, quite rightly. I think I'd probably pick it as well. So I have said my reaction to it many times in other podcasts, so I won't bore the listeners. So why Dalek in particular, other than you bloody love Daleks?
I bloody love Daleks, apparently. I think there's a little bit of fun here, because the premise is I'm in a bunker, aren't I? And what I noticed with nearly every story I've picked is about getting out of a bunker or a hole or a prison. It's all about escape. I think maybe psychologically I would be like, I don't want to be in this bunker. I need to get out. I want to, you know, I need to work out a way out. I've got to go plant.
So you've picked aspirational escape, Doctor Who.
Bit, yeah. But at the same time, a little bit of it is like, oh, I love this, you know, when I was picking, you know, there's so many to choose from. And suddenly thought, yeah, but if I was in a bunker, maybe I've taken this premise too seriously.
No, it's brilliant when people do. Most people do.
If I was in a bunker, would I really want to watch this episode? This one seems a bit depressing. Yeah, but absolutely. I think one reason is he won't remember, or he might, but I met Rob Shearman at a convention once this was nearly 10 years ago now. It's 2014. Before I illustrated, I was trying to get a degree in classics in Exeter University.
Oh, wow.
And it didn't work out because, you know, it wasn't really my subject. I was in a bit of a funny place at the time. So there was a lot of family stuff going on. And but they have a Doctor Who Society, and of course I joined up straight away. I was like, yes, got to do that. And it was really fun. We'd like get out, you know, book out lecture halls to watch classical, you know, current episodes. I haven't, like a confession I've had, which for the longest time I was worried, you know, would kind of bar me from, you know, being involved in Doctor Who, was that I hadn't watched a huge amount of the classic stuff. Now, with everything having come on iPlayer, you can do that. We can finally just watch it without having to have a zillion DVDs. I'm so excited. But yeah, we had a really good time. And they organised this little convention, and Robert Shearman was a guest. Annika was a guest.
Mm.
And so were, I think it was Barnaby, the Dalek controllers.
Barnaby Edwards.
I thought it was Barnaby Edwards. I was like, was it Barnaby Edwards, or was he someone I went to school with? I can't remember. And
sound like that, Peg.
Well, yeah. Oh, we all knew a Barnaby Edwards, and yeah. Oh, it was so fun. I really enjoyed being there and watching, and it seemed like such a bunch of lovies in the nicest way possible. I don't think that's not a nice thing to say, but people who were really passionate and really, you know, loved what they did, loved the things that were around it, like, you know, Barnaby's got his art. Nicholas has, you know, talked about David Bowie, talked about Kate Bush, and I love Kate Bush. So I was like, oh my God, these people could be my friends. It's amazing, you know how that goes. Robert Shearman did a talk, and he was just so sweet, and he was really humble about it. And yeah, when I watched, I think to go into actually talking about Dalek rather than talking around it, yeah, I think it's really heartbreaking. For a start, and it's annoying and it's confusing that it's heartbreaking, but what I like is that you have this classic character, it's the first time they're coming back on screen. You know, what a way to reintroduce them, because you look at the design, it's, you know, there was so much debate about whether or not they were going to come back at all, because it just felt so sort of quote-unquote silly. You're just like, these pepper, how are children going to find this scary? How is this going to have the impact? To bring it back in the way you did to tell this story, it was quite, when I say you, in the way it was brought back, but, you know, in a way that was very complicated and, you know, very, so actually ask questions about what must it be like to actually be a Dalek, how scary and miserable and, you know, gratingly awful that must be. I think that was a really special thing. Read the Target novelization as well. You know, a lot of the metaphors he used, I think he, whenever he uses the voice of the Dalek, the way the Dalek is talking, he describes it as being a little boy.
Mm.
And kind of, the way I read that was kind of, I never want to sound pretentious when I say that, but that's part of the fun, is that you're allowed to be pretentious, it's fine. But because we, you know, we can't put ourselves in the head of a, you know, a hungry creature from another world that is, you know, made of slime and hates more than it can do anything else. But we can imagine what it's like to be a kid. Mm. So it's that approximation, that vulnerability. And then going in, you know, quite gory detail, quite horrible detail about, you know, the sort of visceral experience of being that, how it's this very violent life, you know, of cutting and, you know, mutations and, you know, being born from war, and this, you know, it's indelicate and it's You know, you couldn't imagine that happening to a kid. And it's that kind of, you know, it's that kind of contrast that you have of the two things. They are these terrifying creatures, but they're also very immature.
Yeah, I mean, they're brilliantly pathetic. They are Nazis. So, like all Nazis, they are childlike and simplistic and petulant. You know, they're very petulant, like they are kids. They're just, you can't reason with them because they're just full of hate. And in the most childlike, simple way ever. And that's terrifying as well. But the Daleks are just amazing. And that episode really is. If I ever get to be on the other side of this, I think Daleks probably going to be on my list. It's brilliant in its own right, but also because it brought the Daleks back in such the most spectacular way. I mean, Rob, like you say, Rob being humble is an understatement because he's so self-deprecating. He doesn't want any credit for anything. It's all just to do with Russell T. Davis, like basically putting it in the exactly right part of the season. And there is some truth to that, but also it's still an amazingly, amazingly well-written episode. Absolutely astounding. And I just thank God that they got the Daleks, because Rob, you know, Rob, when I interviewed him, he said it before, when they found out, he sort of just, the funk that descended on him, because he'd written lots of drafts, and then they were like, no, we're not getting the Daleks, you're gonna have to come up with another monster. And I think that's sort of where the Toclophane came from.
Yeah.
It was kind of going to be them, maybe them, which is weird, because when you say kids imprisoned in, you know, children imprisoned, then it's kind of literally, like, that reminds you of that kid in the Toclophane. Thank God they got the... Can you just imagine if the Daleks were sort of absent from Doctor Who and had been for 18 years? They'd be like this weird ghost. It'd be like a version of the unearthly child not being at the beginning of the run on iPlayer. There's this little ghost, absence. But can you imagine Doctor... Doctor Who without the Daleks the controller of BBC said at the time, well, we can't have Doctor Who without the Daleks. I'm sorting this. So whatever it was that went on in the background, and however much they had to pay, whatever they had to do.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
But Doctor Who without the Daleks would have just been a little bit sad. It would have just been, it's come back, but they can't. Yeah. Oh. Even the TV movie had their voice.
We're almost as big as the Doctor himself. You think of the 60s when it came, it was kind of more Dalek mania.
Oh, okay.
They're very iconic looking as well. You could draw one 5 seconds flat. I just said they're really difficult to draw. If you have a stick in and some mud, you can draw a lump. And people know what you're on about.
You can weirdly, my kids have been drawing them. They all go for and obviously they don't get it right, but they're recognisably a pepper pot with balls on it and a gun and an ice door.
Plunger and sticky
and,
bits. It's fine.
Yeah, they're one of the few. I'm not much of an artist, but I did A-level art. But yeah, doing Daleks in Biro. I've done some pretty good Daleks in my time.
Yeah, I'll have to see.
You have done some amazing Daleks in your time, but yeah.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you.
Gods and Monsters, Issue 1, Fausti, written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And Issue 3, Omega, El Trala, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space.
Next is another Eccleston. So that, I mean, I do think that first series of Doctor Who is a miracle of television. Just bringing Doctor Who back and then it not being shit. It passed all these different... To start with, it was like, oh, please don't be shit. Oh, you're not shit. Oh, my God, you're really good. Oh, my God, you're actually amazingly good television. And Doctor Who has come back and it's taken the world again. Just amazing. But the more I look back, the more I mourn that we didn't get more Christopher Eccleston as well. I really, really wish we had more of his Doctor. I love the Big Finish audios for that. But I don't think, I almost think in its 60-year run, I really do think that first series of the new show was the maybe the most consistently good it ever was, even compared to some classic eras and things since. I just absolutely love it. There's not a duff episode. Everything's there for a reason. Everything's there for a reason. But your next choice, as you mentioned before, you couldn't even sleep when you heard this from secondhand from your brother, is The Empty Child / The Doctor Dancers. And I love this episode as well. I mean, just amazing.
Well, obviously, I do, because here I am. Yeah.
But I in a bunker, half starved, if your rations run out, you'll start seeing the kid with the gas mask staring at you out of the dark.
Yeah.
But
it's interesting you say rations, Ian, because it's a story about World War II as well. It's a story about hiding underground to a degree. That was I made that. I was like, sounded like I was going to segue into this really salient point. I wasn't. I was just thinking.
No, you're right. Yeah, because they have the little Anderson shelter down the bottom of the garden and stuff, don't they? And the air raids. I just think it's another perfectly formed, two episodes of Doctor Who, and I mean, Moffat has just created with The Empty Child and The Weeping Angels alone. He's created the two things that, from New Who, that all the kids I know who like the Daleks also know those two. So they're like the excellent. Everything else is good, but they're the two. My son still plays Weeping Angels. They do it.
Icon. Well, all the time. We all do it now. It's kind of like you'll say that more than you'll say What's the Time, Mr. Wolf.
Yeah. But Empty Child, so when did this sort of solidify as one of your favourites in your head?
That's interesting.
How is scared interesting were you when you first actually watched it?
Not very scared at all.
Oh.
I was watching it, when I finally did watch it, I was watching it with my sister. We'd gotten the full collection of Series 1 on DVD, and we were just sitting going with it. And it was like, this was quite far on. I think older than my late teens. I think it was my early 20s. I was like, okay, I'm sure you're not gonna die, let's watch it. And I did. Watching it with her as well, that was really fun. It's often just really fun when you can share, you know, good telly with people. And just me and her just really getting into, you know, this series, really enjoying it. When I saw it, there's just so many elements of it, for better or for worse, but I absolutely love. And you know, first of all, the fear is still there. The gas mask child is this very scary threat. The whole episode, the whole two parts, they just feel incredibly morbid. It's all, you know, this child who's following them around, he's literally death in a way. It's kind of this fear, this thing that I think as well, I think in a time in World War II, naturally there was a lot of propaganda. You know, you keep calm and carry on, everything's fine. Your loved ones are dying all around you. It's this taboo to, you know, you could get in trouble for spreading panic or information like that. It felt almost like, looking at it a little bit, it was, you know, seeing this child in a gas mask who's supposed to be dead, and it being this big, we don't talk about it, we don't touch it. Whenever he comes, we run away from him. That's kind of what I read into it. Also, the more positive elements, you know, sort of like art from artist a little bit. You know, we had Jack Harkness. I love his arc contained within Empty Child, Doctor Dances. Of him being this cynical, you know, in it for the money kind of guy, to going through this adventure, being willing to sacrifice himself by the end to save everyone.
No, it's brilliant.
That's such a good story, such an good introduction to a character who was very beloved, and obviously went on to be part of Torchwood. Amazing coat. You can't fault him for that. I really loved that. It's, you know, it's scary, but it's so joyful as well. It gets to be that, you know, you have that ending for once everyone gets to live. I just genuinely enjoy it. And I think as well, you know, I think just how dark it is, how kind of like, you know, I think the sort of TV tropes term is fridge logic. You know, the crux of why he's saying, "Are you my mummy?" of Nancy, this child, having had a child. You know, that is one of the darkest things, if not ever, but if not ever in Hood, it's such a scary thing to have to go through. But as well, you know, it's almost like you can't, a little bit, it's kind of like, it's quite bold to talk about that and talk about trauma in that way, trying to do your best, having no control over your life, being that young and being in that situation. And that, again, it's a little bit like, as I said earlier, this kind of taboo. You don't talk about it. That doesn't happen. Or if you go through some kind of trauma, it's like, and the complex feeling about it, it's like, you're my son and I love you. But it was such a huge taboo. It was interesting because when I was, I heard this story from my mum, and like, again, if I go on a tangent, you can cut it out. But my mum remembers one of my, for a while, like, she had quite a big family. For a while, when she was a child, I think, her older cousin came to stay with her older aunt. And this was in the 70s, so you didn't talk about these things. My mum didn't really know why. She learned years later it's because this cousin of hers was pregnant as a teenager. And I bring up fact it was the 70s just because my mum couldn't tell, because she was like, well, I didn't see anything. I just know she was wearing a poncho most of the time. It's like the fashion would have physically covered that. And it's like, you look at Call the Midwife and stuff like that, you did not talk about that kind of thing.
No, you went away to have your baby, and then you your baby was didn't come back with a baby because you put it up for adoption. No. But yeah, but I just, I mean, you're just right. And I think it's weird that everyone lives thing. Moffat gets stick for it later on, that too many people come back from the dead. But I think in this one, it was the first season. But also, it is
kind of the first time he'd done it, yeah.
Yeah, and it is unreal. It's kind of brilliant, but it's really, really unrelentingly grim. So the fact that they have everyone, just this once everyone lives, you've gone through the ringer before you get to that point. So you don't mind.
Oh my God, yes.
Like, oh, brilliant, everyone does live. Actually, that did make a change, because the Doctor's been surrounded by death so far since we've come back.
Yeah.
Absolutely brilliant. But also, one of my favourite things about it is Florence Hoth as Nancy, retired from acting, but just absolutely brilliant performance, and Nancy's such a lovely part as well. But yeah, but
she really is.
But without her as its sort of emotional core, everyone else is sort of dancing around it, but she's just this solid. Yeah. Brilliant character at the centre.
She's so loving and so motherly and so
tough as well.
Determined.
There it is, the sweat of your brow when she's taken on the guy, the butcher or whatever it is, the guy who's Sunday Rose she's nicking. The sweat of your brow.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant line. I've watched this episode so many times because it always works on kids. So if you've ever got kids seen Doctor Who, cousin, you know, my nieces and nephews, and it's like, yeah, it's I mean, my niece is now 18, just a birthday party the other day, she said, yeah, you showed me The Empty Child when I was 3 and I had nightmares for a month.
Oh my word.
So yeah,
I have so many experiences.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Yeah, she's 18 now and she still remembers very distinctly how terrified she was of being followed by the empty child.
Free on DVD with issue 6 of Warp Warp.
I stopped the car at last and let the fog close in around
me. Brand new animation by Mel.
I knew I was somewhere on Barnes Common, and I had a suspicious idea it was the most deserted part as well.
Adapted from the opening chapter of Doctor Who and the Daleks by David Whittaker.
I'm Barbara. Barbara Wright, Susan. Susan was in the road.
A meeting on the common.
Oh my goodness.
I say, you there. Are you trying to get us all killed? There's petrol everywhere.
Featuring Stephen Noonan.
What are you doing here?
As the First Doctor. Out now. Order online at warpwarp.co.uk. Before we get on to your next choice, we're going into the Tennant years. So before that, I thought we could talk about
your time on Iris Wildtime. What's it been like now you've just delivered your, is it 28 pages for us?
It wasn't quite 24. Yeah. It doesn't sound good me pointing out that I apparently don't know how many pages.
I'm the editor. But anyway, let's say 24 pages. The 24 pages.
Of Iris
Wildtime. So obviously the script was written by our very own Sean Mason years ago now, because these things, you artists take your time. No, joking. You do the job that takes ages. It really does take ages to do the art. But it's brilliant. But what's it been like working on Iris? And obviously our version of Iris is with Katie Manning's blessing, is taken from her, sort of the way she looks.
Yeah. Well, I think there was certainly a bit of anticipation in the sense that, you know, you want to get it right. You want to make sure that when people look at her in the comic, they know that it's Katie Manning. So I want to do that. And, you know, it's this very popular character, it's this really beloved actress. She's, you know, amongst Who fans, she's so involved, she's such a big part of it, and rightfully so. It was a little bit kind of like, oh my god, I've got to get this right, I don't want to upset anyone. But at the same time, Iris is just such a fun character to get to do, so it's really been an honor, I have to say. I think we all kind of secretly or less secretly have an idea of, yeah, but if I was a Time Lord, what would I do? What would my TARDIS be? What would my sonic device be? And, you know, from the start, she has her London bus. You couldn't really get more perfect than that.
Mm.
And it's as well, you know, sort of being an older woman, sort of this being disgraceful in space is absolutely delightful, because you know, if you contrast her with the Doctor, who, you know, as potty as they can be, they try and be responsible, so does Iris.
Mm.
But she does it in such a completely different way. It's kind of this feeling of, this is who I want to be. I need to be like this. I want to be the universe's Taurus, you know. We've got to do this. So I was doing all, so there's all of that to bear in mind. As well, for me, a lot of the fun and a lot of the challenge was doing the research and all the characters and all the elements surrounding her, because essentially that was all up to me. I had to think, okay, you make it, you know, because you always have this idea of this universe you'd make in your head, then you actually have to do it. And even if it's really fun, it can be such hard work, because you have to think of every little element. It opens more or less on a mining town, and suddenly it's like, oh no, well, what do it's in space, but what do mines have? Do they have, how do people dress typically? You know, how can I tweak this in a sci-fi setting? You know, and later it's in the jungle. It's an extraterrestrial jungle, so it's like, you want to do all of these trees, but you also have to do, how do I show this is a different planet, this isn't just Earth? I want to, you know, sometimes having things like Earth is wonderful, but it can be a bit of a cop-out when you've got, you know, it can look like more or less everything. So fun, especially Lena was, you know, again, she is the co-star of the comic, the partner in time, and she is a thief. But again, the script didn't have a description of her, so I have to come up with what the character looks like. And that was a very enjoyable thing to do. It is quite fun when you do get to have your own stamp on something.
Mm-hmm.
I did, and there were lots of designs, lots of consistency. She is obviously escaped from the pirate crew. She's stolen something from them. Now she's on the run, and they want her done something. And these pirates, Androver and his gang, they're all different shapes and sizes, all of these aliens. It's like, oh no, you know, I've decided this cast of aliens, we've got to think, what do they look like? Let's, you know, have some variety in there. I am so proud of Androver's design. I have to say, I'm a little bit chuffed, but I'm not tooting my horn too much. I had something I did that I was quite proud of was that all the pirates have these facial markings, which is they have two dots under their eyes, they have multiple eyes, you know, have multiple, and on Androva, their captain, on sort of his eyebrows, he has these two natural markings, which are, you know, these two dots.
Mm.
And there's this little bit of consistency there. It's almost like a sort of like, almost like a gang sign or something. Mm. And, you know, Lena, who's trying to run away from there, you know, she's got this on her now. She can't get rid of it. Is that going to be with her forever kind of thing? So, yeah, it was, I really enjoyed doing it. I think the script was wonderful. Really excited for everyone to see it, but at the same time, you know, I'm quite nervous because it's a big undertaking.
That'll be grand, isn't it? There'll be another one along from Sean for you before long.
I'm
at some point writing one that we want you to do, the affirmative, which is very different vibe because it's going to be a Doctor Who fan in the Doctor Who. Yeah, oh, there's K-9.
Hey.
A Doctor Who fan with a model K-9 in the early 80s in grimy old Northampton.
I could enjoy that too.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I like a bit of realism as well.
I thought
Pixar, Russell T. Davis, I did like his kind of, you know, a lot of people have mentioned it. It's like appreciating Earth and people and like make it the mundane things for sort of not so... sort of slightly rotten things for not so pretty things. I did really appreciate that because it says a lot. It says a lot about in all of the world, in all of space, that's what's important. But yeah, as well, I've always liked it being grounded. I like cultural references, you know, something I'm sort of looking forward to doing.
So
thank you very much for that.
I've got to get writing. There's so many things to do, but it's as you've seen, part of the scripts there, isn't it? I've just got to do the other 50-odd pages. But on to your next choice, which is, because I'm doing them in order, into season three. Is it three? Two? No, two. Is it Tennant's first season, The Impossible Planet, and The Satan Pit?
Yes.
It is his first season.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it has Rose in it. And she doesn't make it properly into season three, does she? So, yes.
No, she doesn't.
So, we're into season two, David Tennant's first season, The Impossible Planet, The Satan Pit. And you said this is when you were really following it. So, is David Tennant your doctor?
I think when people say my doctor, it's going to sound pretentious. I want to say I don't have a doctor because I think we all bring something to it. It was so wonderful. Having said that, you know, David Tennant being as hugely popular as he is, it's not undeserved by any means. He is such a good actor. He sells everything so well. And, you know, as a fan as well, you know, just how passionate he is about it. You know, even the most bizarre scenario you can see, even, you know, you can see him put his all into it and really, you know, even in some episodes later where perhaps, you know, later, even in ones that aren't so popular, he put so much into it. And, you know, this example, Satan Pits, Impossible Planet, is definitely one of them. I think we all fell in love with him, definitely in series two. But I think, so many parts of it are what make me love it. Again, I think I've picked a lot of the ones that I have for the Cutaway Bunker. Again, I've talked about escape a little bit, but a lot of it's about hope as well.
Mm-hmm.
This is such a scary two-parter. There is so much going on. It is, you know, away from the sort of morbid reality of the Second World War that we were just talking about with The Empty Child. It is sort of superstitious fear, superstitious terror. You know, it's just so, so good. And there are lots of elements in Inevitable. Like, it's in space, but you kind of get a bit of folk horror in there, in a way. I think it's played really well within the soundtrack. And I love my folk horror. That's the whole thing. I wrote my dissertation on folk.
I love my folk horror. But yeah, it's definitely got a sort of event horizon.
It's the devil,
vibe,
yeah. It's
sort of event horizon is most definitely part of its DNA, but it does it so amazingly well.
Yeah.
And obviously it's got the marvellous Gabriel Wolf, who I've been lucky enough to direct.
Oh.
Who was Sutek in Pyramids of Mars, obviously.
Oh,
but
my God.
But as the voice of the beast. He got to be our Sutek in a trailer, and I got to direct him, and he's 90 something and absolutely
goodness.
still on it. Brilliant stuff. But But yeah, I just this is again one of the standout episodes for me as well, because it's based under siege. It's got that, you know, alien Event Horizon vibe, which I can never get enough of that. A bunch of people wearing scruffy stuff running through steam filled corridors on a spaceship.
Yeah.
But then it's got that, like,
get your exercise in.
Yeah.
You get your 100 steps.
Then, like you say, it's got the folk horror element, the devil himself down the bottom of the pit. And obviously the Oods. Oods feel like they've been around forever as well. They're an amazing invention by
Sea. And I do love the Oods. I do love them a lot. I think they're really graceful, you know, for a sort of spaghetti face of monster, they're so graceful. In a way, for a bit of rubber and prosthetics put on a guy.
Yeah.
They're terrifying. And I often think with their design, it reminds me of an elephant a little bit. I think it's the way their eyes are placed. And I associate it with those sort of big, you know, these big, gentle, smart animals.
Well, I always thought
a little bit as well with
Well, I always thought they were kind of a little bit like the elephant man as well, because they're really nice and polite. And
completely.
You're very kind. I'm an Ood. You're very kind.
They and then, you know, and how well they fit into that story, kind of like, it's horrible the end when they don't get saved and they all get sucked in. But just like, no, can't you save at least five of them? You know, I'm so glad they come back, because you know, you see them all there. There's some, my friend pointed out the other day when they were rewatching it, there's like a pair of them are like hugging each other, and it's like, no, don't stop. That's really sad. And you know, they're innocent in this as well. The fact that they get possessed and they get used is, you know, and that's another scary unknown element of it.
Yeah.
I like, you know, sort of not, well, I am going to go into it, but kind of like the fact that sort of like terrestrial earth theology, you know, is apparently, maybe there is a devil. Apparently this is like a universe-wide thing. Yeah, that does make it so scary, because it's like, and it's a story all about faith. It's kind of a big reason why I chose it. You know, it's like, you know, without going into belief so much, not because it can get a bit trite. It's an interesting discussion to have, but sometimes, you know, you don't want to be going on about it forever, or what you believe or what you don't believe, because that doesn't really fit. It's like having faith in people. There are these huge, seemingly insurmountable beings, but the Doctor trusts Rose, this girl who works in a shop, who doesn't see herself as being valuable at all, who is so wonderful, and he loves so much. In you know, whichever way, shipping aside, you know, that's definitely there. He knows that she'll do, he's sure that she'll do the right thing. And it's kind of like, no matter how much you try to scare me, how big and mighty you think you are, you can be overcome. And I think that's absolutely wonderful. Obviously, that's why I put it on the list. Yeah, it really is a beautiful two-parter. Toby with the marks on his face as well, and the bit when there's something behind him and all you can hear is the voice. It's another just lying awake at night in bed thinking you're not alone, thinking, well, that couldn't happen, could it? Or could it? Maybe it can happen. There's that Uncanny series I've listened to the podcast, but on the BBC at the moment, all about
Danny Rubin,
you have or haven't seen ghosts.
Yeah.
I'm terrified of ghosts.
I'm a huge fan of, I mean, on a different podcast, I've interviewed Danny Robbins. When Battersea Poltergeist came out. Yeah, he's lovely.
Yes.
But I could talk about that as a sidebar for
that. We could do that.
Anyone, go and listen to Uncanny and Battersea Poltergeist and the Witch Farm and all of it.
I've just moved. You may have noticed my house.
I was going to say, where you live looks quite folk horror-y. Nigel, you're in a Nigel Neal. I just rewatched. Have you ever seen Baby by Nigel Neal?
Baby, no.
It's on YouTube. I just rewatched it yesterday for the first time in years, and it still scared me. If you're easily scared and you're in a house by yourself, maybe don't. But it's 1975.
That makes it creepier somehow. It's
1975, and it's Nigel Neal, and it's a really good script. But it's all about well, you'd have to see it, but it is, it's basically the protagonist is a pregnant woman and there's a sort of curse on the land, so nothing gives, or no, but basically there's a curse on the land, so cows always lose their calves, and she starts getting paranoid, and her husband is a big brute who does who just thinks she's a superstitious idiot, and then they find something in the wall which is really creepy. Which
you have just sold me 100%.
It's not, I mean, obviously go and buy the DVD, but it is on YouTube.
Yeah.
And it's really good. There's something weirdly creepy about watching it in a grainy version on YouTube as well, because it's so intimate and it seems like it's been beamed at you from the past, which it has.
Yeah, you can't, you don't know what's going on in it. You can't see things so well. So it's like, that makes it more creepy in a way.
It is really creepy. Really. It's amazing how something that old, and it's, you know, it's quite creaky because it starts off with really bad sound effect of a cat. So she's carrying a basket and you just hear this cat. Yeah. And he's literally like the worst cat grams turned up far too loud. It's like, I think that might not be a real cat.
You're listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Comics, publisher of creator-owned comics based on characters and stories set in the Doctor Who universe. For more on Cutaway, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.
So, away from the folk horror of the Satan Pit and onto, which I do believe, your happy place is where we first see the human Dalek that you love so much.
That is
Daleks in Manhattan / Evolution of the Daleks. And as I said in our emails, this gets a lot of hate, these two episodes. And I've never understood why, because I really liked it. And I watch it with my kids. I've watched it with all three of my kids as we've grown up. As they've grown up. I haven't grown up. And
it's a trap, don't do it.
And they've all absolutely loved it. And playing Pig Slave, me being a Pig Slave, has been part of all three of their childhoods ever since the
year.
Running after them in the playground. I'm still doing it like nearly 15 years later because my youngest is still 8. So every so often I do Pig Slave and Chase or Pig Man, whatever we call it. But I just think it's a brilliant two-parter. What do you like about it? Other than human Dalek. Yes. What's his name, Dalek?
Dalek Sek.
Yeah.
Yes. I think so much of what has gone into that and me liking it has been so formative, for better or for worse. I was, when I first saw it, when it first aired in 2007, I was 11 and later turned 12 that year, big time, going into secondary school. I think something that jumped out at me when I first saw it, I think something that made it really stick in my head was, of all things, it was the setting. Because when you grow up, you kind of get to a way where you kind of get raised by American TV. A lot of what's going on is American. You know, we were the era who was watching Disney videos and stuff like that. A lot of my favourite ones, which usually have mice in them for some reason. you know, things like The Rescuers is set in New York. You get this beautiful painted backgrounds of the city and the skyline and the atmosphere. I haven't been that Stuart Little. When I was little, I absolutely loved those films. I have some funny stories about it, but that's for another time. But I was obsessed. So I think having that setting, having it be in New York City, was kind of instantly, it felt very nostalgic into somewhere where I had never been. I still haven't been, although I have been to America.
To New York. I lived there for a bit. It's hectic, but it's brilliant.
Yeah, I'm pretty good at hectic. I think I've already got the kind of, I walk fast, I think I'll be fine.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
If you can handle London, you can handle New York. It's about the same pace.
I do like London as well, so I can do that. But yeah, there was that. I love, it's just so much nostalgia. Like, sort of part of the idea was old movies. You know, you've got this 1930s setting, you've got Tallulah and her musical number, you've got it's very glamorous. The bits which are glamorous, even, you know, the pig slaves, although they're kind of goofy, there's something kind of endearing and familiar about that proper kind of gnarly monster. Kind of.
I love the fact it makes no sense that the Daleks have decided to augment people with pigs, but
I have some bad news. Brilliant. It makes sense. You know that I will have thought about this
before. Oh, okay.
I overthink everything.
Well, let's hear your headcanon. I haven't given it
all
to
right, well,
you.
Well, I just don't even know. It's not even a headcanon. It's I say this as if this is true of research. This all actually happened, by the way. Out of all the Doctor Who stories, this one's the one that's true.
Oh, those famous pig slaves they found in Central Park.
Yeah. Oh, those pig slaves. No, in well, we studied the Great Depression, well, the sort of boom of the '20s and the bust of the Great Depression in the 1930s, we happened to study that and was very excited for GCSEs. And in when it happened, a lot of farmers were forced to kill all of their livestock because they couldn't, it was too expensive to keep raising them without being able to sell them for the price that it took to raise them. So they just killed them all. That would have included pigs. So imagine some guy turns up willing to take them all off your hands for a reasonable price. You've got as many pigs as you want. There's also, in real science, people often, you know, pigs are often used, you know, you've had people have like transplants of organs from pigs now, because they're thought to be quite similar to humans in the sense that they're intelligent. Yeah. Sadly, you know, there are these other similarities. Sadly, you know, a lot of like animal testing, cosmetics testing and stuff, you will use a pig because its skin is quite similar to humans.
Yeah, well, we're called long pork for a reason, aren't we?
Yeah, we are long pork, yes. And so that's been my headcanon. And I think originally it wasn't supposed to be a Dalek story. So it was more, it would have been more of a standalone story with these pig people running around. And that's one criticism, is everyone is like, what's with the pig people? Why are they here? Everyone just gets completely confused.
I like them. The Daleks always need sentries, especially when there's only five of them. They can't just zoom around Manhattan doing
there's stuff. Five of them? There was a fifth one? Where was it?
Oh, well, you know what I mean. It was,
yeah,
but they always have the Robo Men, or they have somebody doing stuff, so that
the old Grons.
They always have servants because they're the master rogue that apparently needs quite a lot of help.
It's the irony of that, of being a robot, of being, you know, we're so perfect, but can you open this can for me?
Yes.
Absolutely. You know, without waxing too lyrical, was a story that meant the world to me. I think in terms of Dalek stories, you know, I have a bias because I would say this. It is such a good one in the sense of it talks so much about what it means to be a Dalek. It's one where they're not just a foil for the Doctor to defeat to show how great the Doctor is. They have personalities. They disagree with each other. They have ideas, even outside of Dalek sec. You get these little bits of character acting with the Daleks, like them asking questions in turn, the one sort of checking behind it to make sure no one's watching.
Yeah.
If Sec was there, what would he do? Slap them? I don't know.
No, I love it, and it's I think it's you could sort of apply to it as well that the Daleks are basically a Nazi analogy, you know, an extremist, hateful ideology. And one of the things about those people who hold those views is when they're actually in power, they're usually, as horrible and nasty as they are, their own prejudices usually undermine them. And that happened with Hitler, because they got rid of all the good scientists who were Jewish. He thought he was a genius, all these different things.
Yeah.
And it happens over and over again with these extremist views. It happens in this. It's Dalek Sec has a really good idea, but the other Daleks are like, no, it's blasphemy. He's impure. Yeah. We're not humans.
No.
So they kill the person that might be able to actually help them. But I also love the scene where the Daleks are talking. They're talking about everywhere we go, there's a city like this on every planet. You know, the humans are always. I just love that little bit of sci-fi. when you take
it's so good.
You take the sort of what is basically a preposterous idea about alien pepper pots, but you use this, but you have them as characters and they're philosophizing, and and they are, you know, the Daleks have seen the humans throughout time and space always building massive cities, always doing well. Why do they do well? Because we're not a bunch of fascists, generally. That's why.
It's usually a good thing when we're not.
That's why Daleks. But no, I just think it's actually marvelous too. I love Martha as well. She's one of my favorite companions. I'd like to see more
of her. She's always so wonderful. I do. You know, it's just such a happy place seeing Creamer on screen. Because she just seems like such a warm person. She's such a courageous character. You know, she often gets a lot of flack for, you know, for falling in love with a doctor. And I do understand that a little bit.
Yeah, it's a little bit of, is that the only thing a female character can do? Fall in love with the doctor. So there is a little criticism to be leveled there.
But yeah, no, her sort of playing second fiddle to Rose for a bit. But when I put myself in her shoes, if a spaceman came, I'd fall head over heels in love with him.
You look like David Tennant.
I would. Oh yeah, he's human. I would have been in love with him right until the moment I saw Dalek Sec, and then I realised I could do so much better. That's a joke.
Of his magical dreadlocks, but
yeah.
I wonder if you love Dalek Sec so much because you were saying. I mean, obviously, you can draw a really good Dalek, but you draw organic. You're not naturally drawn to drawing robots and straight lines. So I wonder if it's like, here's a Dalek who's also a blobby, who's also got more of a more rounded shapes to him and stuff like that. Because you certainly draw a brilliant, brilliant Dalek Sec. And I know it's behind you. Is that a knitted Dalek Khan?
I can do a Khan. That's my next project. This is pre-hybrid Dalek Sec.
Oh wow! Of course it is. You knitted it.
It's a pity that it's in it's a pity that this is audio.
I'll take a screen grab. So hold it up, and I'll take a screen grab when
make him look angry. He can.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of. He looks. I'll take a screen grab now.
Wow! Brilliant.
We see this creature eat a man alive.
We do. Don't we?
So I decided to knit it so that he can be in my house always. Because that's the same thing to do.
Doctor Who fans, I don't think sane comes into it. But brilliant. But yeah, no. I love Dalek Sec. Yeah. I wonder if there's ever a way for him to come back.
Well, it was interesting because we were...
Probably not a great clamour from the fandom. Since it doesn't rate highly in people's affections. But I also
think if you brought him back, then people would say, well, why are they bringing him back and not this idea from this time? It's like, all right. As well, I think the practical side of it would have been very, very hard. Apparently, it wasn't a lot of fun to film, to be in all that makeup.
Yeah.
You know, Eric Lauren, the actor, heard him in an interview. He said, you know, he could only eat very little. He had to have everything through a straw. As well, he couldn't see a bloody thing.
Yeah.
And you couldn't hear what was going on because you've got these tentacles going. So they're all in your ears. And, you know, this is another, you know, I love Eric Lauren. And I did get to meet him, so I can tell you about that in a sec. Wow. But, you know, it's another reason why I rate David Tennant so high, because he said, you know, I have so much to thank him for, because he really took the time with me when I was in that costume to, like, really sort of block out what we were going to do and how we were going to work out where we're going to be at this time. And, you know, really, you know, you really, really helped him out. They really worked well together, and they are, you know, it's subjective always. Lots of people laugh at his appearance. Like, obviously it doesn't rate highly. You don't want to admit that you have the sort of, that you like the questionably faced alien. he has the sort of odd husky voice going on, but it's sort of like quasi Brooklyn accent. you know, Dalek meets Taxi Driver.
You're talking to me.
Hey, come on. kind of thing. But you know, I find it kind of endearing. It's funny because I was talking to someone, you know, in a comment section of a YouTube video, and they said it's funny because loads of people hate it, but they said, you know, my family's all from Staten Island, and they all kind of talk a bit like, they sound exactly like that, you know, Sam's the Dalekiness, but it's like, you know, it's quite endearing because he sounds like my family. So that's kind of sweet. Better or for worse, you know. Yeah. And I heard he put a lot. He put a lot of. I feel like that role was played with a fair bit of sensibility as well. Again, I have a bias, but
I'd agree. I think people are too busy worrying about some Doctor Who fans. I think part of whatever it is, the DNA that makes us fans is sometimes there's a negativity, like always.
Mm.
Like you put stuff. I know from putting our own stuff out there. You put stuff out and lots of people are going, oh, that's amazing. Oh, I love it. I'm going to retweet that. And somebody go, oh, he's holding the match wrong. Or, you know, there's like all this amazing stuff. And your contribution is to point out, you know, it's to point out the bit that maybe you don't like. And is that how you approach, you know, is that how you approach everything? And then you look in the feeds and yes, it is. They just are picking at things. And it's like, I'm a fan of a show that I think is rubbish, judging by my feed, because it's never been right.
completely. Jesus. Such a big thing.
But instead, like, you know, there's some amazing stuff. And you're right. I like the story. I love the hybrid Dalek. I love the storyline of it. Like I said, it works on a deeper level than just being the Daleks decide to shoot him. It's brilliant. Mm. And obviously, we've not even mentioned Spider-Man yet, have we? So Andrew Garfield, one of his early roles. I was telling people for years Andrew Garfield was one of the pig slaves, and it was only when I rewatched it, I don't know, maybe 10 years later, I realised, oh no, that's not quite true. That would have been brilliant. But no,
he's the guy who's most definitely from TLC. But yeah, I'm picking holes now. I think you have to do it. You have to show you're not. Oh, I'm too cool. I'm not too into this thing. You know, I'm. You know, but yeah, no. I remember when I first saw the first trailers for The Amazing Spider-Man, I was like, wait a minute, that face. He looks familiar. He's been in my favorite Doctor Who episode, and you know, amazing for him going on to have all the success that he's had. You know. And I really like Frank as a character in the thing. You know, it helps that it's Andrew Garfield because he's lovely. But, you know, having this human element, I think, as a part of it, it's such a vulnerable story, it being set around the Depression.
Mm.
It's so relevant now. I watch it now. I watch Diagoras, you know, being the worst person who could ever employ you ever. And I think so much about the whole, oh, nobody wants to work anymore. You know, you think of inflation, you think of, you know, it's, you know, earlier, just before I came on, I actually watched the, I was sort of scrubbing through the Confidential, them talking about making Hooverville in a park in Wales and in New York, and talking about this, you know, this dispossessed, I hope I don't do the thing where you say a word, it doesn't mean what you think, thought it did, but population of people who can't afford stuff, you know, who are intensely vulnerable, getting taken advantage of, specifically about the predatory nature of the Daleks, how they find this population, they exploit the hell out of it. It's very scary. It's very, you know, it's so relevant. Everything about it, including, you know, the ideology around Dalek Sec and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I also think that's another thing, that the Nazis arose from the Depression. That's,
yeah,
you write a massive essay on this episode. Should anyone ever want one? But
I was going to become a YouTube star. I was going to talk all about it. Yeah. I have a very opinionated.
Yeah. Out now from Cutaway Comics, part 2 of the Gods and Monsters saga.
And so I am banished.
Sutek.
Robbed of physical form. Set adrift in the black void between galaxies. Not for the first time. For I am Sutek. Destroyer, sworn enemy of all creation. And creation has many defenders. But this defeat feels different. Something new gnaws at what remains of my diminished soul. Not merely defeat, but something I dare not even name.
Sutak. Sutak, hear me.
Next fists.
Yes, O brother husband. Let my voice guide you back to me and home to Netiketet.
The land of the dead. And yet, for me, it means life, a reprieve. And for the first time in millennia, a body.
In this place, you will always have form, or the appearance of form. But this you know, I have been granted permission to save you, but not restore you.
You always were weak, sister wife. Sentimental. The others would have let me die.
And they would have been justified in doing so. You were brought into this universe to bring chaos and suffering and death, but as part of the greater whole, you played a role in the balance of all things. And then, brother, husband, you forgot your place.
I declared war on all life.
You went insane. Even I, my love, wished death upon you. Only now...
You need my insanity.
Yes.
Who do you want me to kill?
An animated version of this trailer, starring Gabriel Wolf as Sutek and Zoe Iqbal as Nephthys, is one of the features on the VAM disc that comes free with the comic, only when you purchase direct from us at cutawaycomics.co.uk. Anyway, finally, we move away from David Tennant. No, Matt Smith. How were you when Matt Smith took over from David Tennant? Did you sulk? Was it too much? I was a bit like that with Peter Davison. And then now I love Peter Davison. Yeah. But at the time, I was like, you know, why is it not Tom Baker anymore? And David Tennant was a similar thing because he was there, brilliant as he was probably there just a bit too long. And it's, so it's hard to take over. I thought Matt Smith was excellent though.
Yeah, for Matt Smith, it was like the height of my generation. Anyway, it was the height of Doctor Who's popularity.
Oh, wow, really? Yeah.
Global. I loved Matt Smith. I really did. When I watch him back, like, unfortunately, I am one of those people who's really not really critical. I have a lot to say about Moffat's writing, but at the same time, I do love it. You know, you can critique something and then still be very fond of it.
Yeah,
obviously, there are things about, you know, things that irk me about, you know, Matt Smith's Doctor in particular, but I'm not going to go into it. I'm going to be positive, you know.
Yeah,
he was just so fun. He was kind of, he's like the person you feel like you are in your head when you're excited about something.
Yeah.
He made being a nerd cool.
Yeah.
There was the whole bow ties a cool thing. He was very quotable. I loved Karen Gillan. In particular as well, I loved Rory, and I loved Amy. She was a character I really looked up to. Again, Karen Gillan, actress who absolutely sells it. Every time I look back and I see it, I'm just kind of, I remember this place I was in and how I just felt so much of it. I was just completely there and I loved it. I love Jenna Coleman as well. I kind of had a lot of a fondness for her. She's a woman who turned into a Dalek. So it was like, oh, she's like me. She's like the Dalek girl.
Are you jealous? Why can't I wake up and be a Dalek?
They're awake all the things you could be. You could be anything. I probably wouldn't pick a Dalek. That would be at least I don't know. I feel like you could get out of a lot of things by being a Dalek.
You could
get into a lot more. Worse. But I think so. For a start, Peter Capaldi. We were talking about favorite doctors.
Yeah.
For all my love of David Tennant, Peter Capaldi is probably my favorite.
Yeah. That brings us on to your next choice, then, or your final choice, which is The Mighty Heaven Sent. But Capaldi, then I agree. I think Capaldi is just an amazing doctor. I don't think his run is perfect, but and I think it. I always look at it and go, I wish they'd just given him bigger hair right from the beginning.
From the
literally
start.
As simple as that. Just give him bigger hair, and because it was weird when it was
sort
weird.
Of short hair.
When
it was
like, oh,
quite right, like, was it?
My son said, oh, he looks like Skeletor. And as soon as he came on, that was his first impression of Peter Capaldi. But I just think he's an amazing actor, obviously, it goes without saying. And I think when it's a good, you know, at its best, I think it's amongst the best it's ever been, Doctor Who. That his last season, especially, is, you know, I love Bill Potts and all that. But
I do. But, one of my favourite companions.
Yeah, I'd agree. Again, we could have had more of her.
Yeah,
But anyway.
Her fate is a painful one, yes.
Oh, just brilliant. Yes. But anyway,
so,
you didn't pick Bill Potts. You get to
No, I didn't.
Bill
for all
Potts
of me
again.
Saying that.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
escaping, remember? That's
yeah,
why you're
yeah.
here.
So,
one.
Heaven Sent, escaping. Because one thing a lot of people say is, oh, actually, Heaven Sent's brilliant, but I don't know if I want to watch it a lot. So actually, I'm going to pick one of Nymon. But it is. I rewatched it just the other day with my son. My son suddenly switched it on. He hasn't switched. He hasn't been drawn to Capaldi before, and he switched Heaven Sent on and watched it all and was working out. Suddenly, he's just in. He was like really excited when I said, "Oh, whose skulls do you think they are?" In the bottom of the thing, and then he loved the idea of
Skeletor.
He loved the idea that he was trapped in a computer and repeating. But so what is it about this, other than the obvious, but what is it about this particular episode that you're going to get to watch?
It's a one-man play. You could watch it without knowing anything about Doctor Who. Okay, there'd be some things that would throw you off, but if it was just like this art piece, it would work really, really well. Some people spoke, you know, I've heard people talk about why it means a lot to them and kind of like as a metaphor for grief. You know, hearing that feels very important to me. Again, we've got his acting, but we've also got the terror. There is creeping terror following him always. In this prison, and I think you're right. I think there is an irony, but it is hard to watch. It's genuinely horrifying, just existential, endless torture that is going on. It's quite harrowing in its way. Even know, I'd heard I think it was from a Terry Pratchett's We Three Men series. I heard about the metaphor of a bird rubbing its beak on the mountain. How long would it take?
Yeah,
to wear through. And you know, thinking about that. When I first read that story, I was like, oh my God, that's a horrible thought. That's such a long amount of time. You can't even conceptualize it. And then having it was a very visual way, him tunneling his way through there.
Yeah. Well, I always say, being slightly more negative, I always think he might have saved himself a billion years if he'd written Shawshank Redemption in dust. Instead of Bird.
This is where I confess I haven't seen Shawshank Redemption yet.
Oh, big spoiler, but there's some digging.
Something, yeah.
That happens a lot. But yes. Over decades. Mm. Oh, you should watch But yes,
everyone says they watched it, it became their favourite film. I mean to, but I just haven't. It's when you haven't got around to it. I like Stephen King.
I think you'll like it.
I think I might like it.
Yes, it's a very watchable film as well. Like Titanic or something, it's just works every time.
Yeah. I have, for Heaven for Heaven Sent, I think, I do wonder if it is like maybe a bit of a peer pressure thing for me picking Heaven Sent. It's not completely, it is ultimately a hopeful story. Again, it's like something that's literally impossible turns out not to be so impossible after all, in a very abstract way. I think a little, you know, often when people talk about something and they say, oh, it's really, really great, you kind of do rate it a little bit. There's that thing saying that if people come into film having read positive reviews, they're more likely to rate that film positively. But if you go in reading negative reviews, you're more likely to view that film negatively. I think it sort of puts that bias in your head. You point out, you either find the things you like about it or you hate about it. Same time, you know, I think it is deserved praise for Heaven Sent. Again, like a lot of these things, they aren't perfect. I think maybe as well, I think it was because I wanted to make up for the Daleks in Manhattan as something that's kind of like one of the most maligned, which is so silly. And that's not the case. I do genuinely think, you know, the fact that, for Heaven Sent, the fact that people who don't really like Doctor Who can watch that and say, you know, that's stuck in my head, that's amazing, it means a lot. I remember when I first actually got into fandom, again, this was at the Doctor Who Society in Exeter. It was kind of our first social, and we were like going on a mini bar crawl as Who nerds I want to do. And I was so excited. I was like, oh, here I am, I found my people. You know, I can't wait. This was also 2014, so it was while all of this was going on, it was Capaldi's first era. And you know, we were there, and then I heard from the other side of the table, one of the guys who was in charge, I'm terrible with names, if he hears this, I hope he doesn't think I'm I hope he doesn't think that this is terrible, he's a bad person, but I remember him saying, we're not watching Daleks in Manhattan, that's shit. I was like, fuck, I like a bad episode. Excuse my French, I hope I'm allowed to swear.
I'll survive. I know, but that gatekeeping is out of order and silly. Yeah. It makes me deliberately want to like these things. I love Love and Monsters. And
I love Love and Monsters.
It's a brilliantly written episode with a shit monster at the end, like most of Doctor Who has a shit monster at the end.
A kid made up that monster. I think it's lovely. That's the sort of monster a kid would make up.
Yeah, yeah.
And now I think I did a drawing of him, and I'll talk to the guy. He's all grown up now. Talked to him a couple of times on Twitter.
Same era. Yeah, because on the Red Button thing, because I did it for another podcast, the Diddly Dumb podcast, I defended Love and Monsters to the Hill, and we watched the old Red Button, which was from the time. Oh. So it was really weird seeing this was literally as it was going out. They recorded the Red Button. So there was no, oh, we've just made the most reviled episode of Doctor Who. I think it's brilliant. It's one of my favourite, but fans being fans, and people being sheep, they all like to think the same. When Russell said the young lad came on, and he was like, and it, apparently he was sulking a bit, and he said, so what do you think of the monster? And apparently he said, I said it should be 60 feet tall.
Hearing that.
Yeah, so he was annoyed that his monster was just Paul K. Peter K. In a suit. Peter K. But yes. But yeah. I think it's a lovely episode. And I always say with all Doctor Who, if it was all Heaven Sent or it was all Genesis of the Daleks, it would be Blake Seven and most people it wouldn't last. But the fact it can be Love and Monsters and Daleks in Manhattan with pig slaves. And Horns of Nymon and Happiness Patrol. It could be so, like you were saying right at the beginning, tone. The fact that Doctor Who goes anywhere in time and space and genre and tone and all smushes up together.
Yeah.
It's just I mean that's why it lasts forever. And you won't like it all. If you approach it from that point of view, you go, where are we this week? What are they trying to do this week? You know?
Yeah.
I still can't quite bring myself to like Robots of Sherwood, but I can, you know, but there's still stuff in it I like. I just can't quite get over the fact that Robin Hood's real. I don't know why.
I don't like the fact they use Bodiam Castle as Nottingham Castle when Bodiam Castle is in Kent. My only gripe.
Yeah, no, I've been castle, there. Though, yeah. But yes. But anyway, It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Libby. And looking at the clock. Oh, my God. It's 10 past 9. So,
goodness.
But that's been brilliant. But No, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I look forward to working with you, and maybe we're going to have a cutaway convention up here in Manchester at some point. So we'll do our best to get our artists up, and because most of us live here, so it'd be good to get the ones that don't. So where do you live?
Nice and central, Devon. Now.
Oh, really, Devon. Yeah, because I've just say near Dartmoor and stuff.
Yeah, basically on Dartmoor, more or less. Yeah.
Oh wow. Oh yeah, we go on holiday there every year now. I've got a friend in Chudley, a village called Chudley.
Oh yeah, drove past Chudley.
Yeah. That's where we go every year now. And make our pilgrimage to the Sontaran experiment.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. Yeah.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by James Stevenson of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe.